Well, this hour, we're going to take your calls with Eric Berger, author of Liftoff, as we talk about Elon Musk and his SpaceX company. And we'll take your calls when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Eric Berger with us. His book is called Liftoff. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Eric, what made you become a meteorologist?
Well, George, we had some pretty early weather here in Houston in the 2000s. We had hurricanes Katrina and Rita that affected. So Katrina hit Louisiana after several hundred thousand evacuees from New Orleans.
Eric, you're breaking up. Let's try to fix your phone a little bit.
Oh, is this there?
Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
No, I are you on a speakerphone?
I'm sorry, does this sound better, George?
No, all of a sudden it just went kaput. I think I'm going to have Tom call you right back, okay? Maybe we can get you a better line. And if not, we'll use your cell phone. So you hang up. And Tommy, get him on a better line, and because it was just too foggy for the rest of the hour, if we can. And we're going to take your calls, of course, with him this hour as we talk about his book, Liftoff, which is an incredible story of Elon Musk. Can you imagine? Have you used PayPal? It's a system where you pay your bills or pay people through your computer, through your smartphone, and they collect a little fee whenever you do a transaction, and that's how Elon Musk made his money. But he made $180 million when he sold out, maybe sold out too soon. Who knows? But I think we got Eric back on. Eric, let's try it now.
Right. Sorry about that.
Perfect. Perfect.
So in Houston, we had some weather events in the 2000s. Katrina sent a bunch of evacuees from New Orleans this way, and then Rita hit the area, and then Hurricane Ike. And I just started writing more and more about weather and at the Houston Chronicle, and decided if I was going to write about weather, I didn't know what I'm talking about. So I got a meteorology certification from Mississippi State University.
So you never became a TV meteorologist or anything like that?
No, actually, I was an online meteorologist mostly. It proved very popular with people.
Oh, that's great. It's a great field. And what do you think of the weather these days? Is it out of whack or what?
Well, it's a little out of whack. I mean, we had this amazing winter storm across Texas for the first time ever.
Oh, my God.
The state was under a winter storm warning.
It froze your wind turbines, didn't it?
It wind turbines, natural gas plants. My power was out, George, for 3 days, and the temperature outside was in the 20s.
Oh, my God. Did your pipes bust?
No. Fortunately, we had a home that had been recently constructed, so there are these pipes. I don't know much about it, but they apparently expand or contract with the temperature.
Oh, that's good.
We got very lucky.
That's good. Let's take some calls. Let's go to David in Ohio to get things started. Hey, David, thanks for calling.
George, this is my first time ever getting through, and I really... you and your guests, and I want to bring up to you and Eric, and there's a small little gas station here in Selma, Ohio, and I got to meet Neil Armstrong.
Oh, how cool is that?
And in our little town's probably about the population, maybe 1,500, and his car, this is 3 years after he had done the moon landing, and it's a red Mustang pulled up, and me and some other boys were hanging around the gas station, and we said, "That's Neil Armstrong." And I hurried home, and I had David Bowie's 45 Space Oddity, and he signed the 45 sleeve of mine. And he said, "This is one strange astronaut on the cover." He said,
"I love it."
But he didn't talk long. He shook all our hands. And I just wanted to talk about, and also I got a question for your guest.
Sure.
Do you think, I enjoy watching the show Ancient Astronauts, do you think our quest to go back to space is caused originally, that was our home? And I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
What do you think of space travel, Eric?
Well, first of all, I'll just echo the caller's sentiments about Neil Armstrong and say that he was a real, real gentleman, and one of the reasons that NASA picked him to be the first astronaut on the moon is because he handled himself so well and was really a pretty modest person, you could see how something like being the first human to land on another world would go to your head. But
yep.
he kept himself pretty well in check.
And I would have thought NASA would have used him more after they returned from the moon, but he really hushed up, didn't he?
He did. He left NASA. He became a professor, and he tried to stay out of the limelight. You know, his crewmate Buzz Aldrin really struggled with that. With the limelight, he had drinking problems, and you know it's been more difficult for him because he was a little bit less sort of centered than Neil Armstrong was.
I was on the Larry King show years ago with Buzz, and I mean, great American. He's still going strong, but boy, you tell him that he didn't go to the moon, he'll pop you one.
That's right, and he also really doesn't like to hear that he was the second man on the moon.
No, he doesn't. And I have been told, and I guess it's public now, that they launched the lunar module to go back to the command module only because they couldn't push their button because of these big gloves they had on. He had to use a Bic pen to stick it into a little tiny buttonhole to launch this thing.
Yeah, I think I've heard that story as well. And that sounds true because those gloves are hard to work. You know, the Apollo program, there was a lot of gum and shoestring engineering that went into those vehicles to make that happen.
Oh, my God. Absolutely. But can you imagine the computer power they had back in 1969 compared to what we have today? Our smartphones have more computer power than they had in that entire spaceship.
Without a doubt. And, I mean, you look at the Falcon 9 rocket now, it can launch a crew autonomously, and that Dragon spacecraft can fly all the way to the International Space Station, dock, undock, and come home without you or, I mean, you or I could fly to the space station in that and not have to touch a button the whole way, George, although we'd have to figure out how to use the space toilet.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So what do you think of extraterrestrial life, Eric?
I think it has to be out there, George. You look at our galaxy and there's, you know, thanks to the Kepler Space Telescope and other instruments, we've discovered literally millions and millions of Earth-like worlds around other stars just in our galaxy. And to think that life couldn't have evolved on those worlds, it just seems to me that almost certainly it had to have. And, you know, I'm glad that we're more and more looking for it to try to find it.
Let's go down to Miami. Carlos is with us. Carlos, take it away.
Hey, good morning. George, it's always a pleasure speaking to you and an honor.
Thank you.
You're the best. Eric, you're a fountain of knowledge, and I want to bring something up to you. Are you aware that NASA uses currently ion thrusters, which tops the speeds of 200,000 miles an hour, and the antimatter rocket could hit speeds of 72 million miles per hour, which is incredible. Is Elon looking into these, or is he aware of these thrusters that NASA is using?
So NASA is using the ion thrusters on its Dawn spacecraft. That was the biggest spacecraft to use them so far, and that was the mission that went out to the asteroid belt, to the asteroid Ceres, and a couple other destinations as well. Those take a long time to get moving quickly.
But once they do, they go,
but it's not really suitable for human spaceflight. As for the antimatter thrusters, I'm not aware of that, Carlos.
That could be one of those sci-fi stories or dark stories that are hidden away. Do you think there's a secret space force out there?
No, just because we would know about launches. I mean, there are now, you know,
You can't hide those, can you?
You can't hide those. I mean, you couldn't even hide them back in the Cold War. You know, we would see the launches from the Soviet Union. And so there's plenty of commercial satellites up there now, George, that are looking at the Earth all the time. And so we can see what's happening.
What about the Space Force? You agree with that concept?
Yeah, I think it's a necessary evolution of what the Air Force was doing. I mean, space is going to be the domain of lots of activity in this century. And certainly, you know, we talked about China during the last hour, and they're very interested in doing activities around the moon and on the moon. And that we ought to contest that space because we ought to try to bring democratic norms to the moon and elsewhere. And so, yeah, the Space Force is an important step in policing that. For now, it's mostly trying to protect our satellite assets in low Earth orbit.
Absolutely. That's what they're going to go after.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's in the near term, that's the biggest threat.
Next up, let's go to Carl in Boston. Hey, Carl, thanks for calling.
Hey, George, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I had a couple questions and a comment. My question is, do you think that we will send AI family into deep space? Or I don't know if it's cryo freezing is sci-fi or not, but sending a human family up with said technology. And then my comment is, does SpaceX have anti-gravity technology like the U.S. government has, or is all that still classified? And I'll take my...
Okay.
So SpaceX does not have an anti-gravity technology, at least that I'm aware of. but it's a great question about sending AIs into space and humans into space. I'd say two things about that. First of all, with regard to AI, you know, as we send humans further into space, you know, they lose contact with mission control. You can talk to mission control before you do maneuvers at the moon, but when it's 20 or 30 minutes to Mars, you really need to be operating the spacecraft independently. And so we're going to see increasingly sophisticated AIs in artificial intelligence in vehicles when we start sending humans to Mars. In terms of how do we get humans to planets around other stars, I think cryo-freezing, you know, sort of putting humans on ice to slow their metabolisms and so they don't age is a potential way that we do that, because certainly in terms of getting there, we don't have any way to get near the speed of light right now, and it just seems like technologically that's going to be difficult to achieve. So we're going to have to find other ways to keep humans alive for hundreds, if not thousands, of years for these interstellar journeys.
Just like these movies where they sleep in these capsules in the ships, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the reason the movies are showing those is because we don't have any other way right now to really do that, and it is theoretically possible to do cryo-freezing.
Isn't it amazing, Eric, the technology of, like, Perseverance on Mars? Just incredible.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you think about it, George. That's a one-ton rover, like the size of a small SUV. You know, it's already traveled 70 meters on the surface of Mars. You know, it's drilling into the ground. It's looking for ancient life. It's stowing samples. There's a helicopter on that thing that's going to fly around in a couple months. I mean, this is heady stuff. It's not easy to build that and land it on Mars.
And aren't they going to launch samples back to us?
So the plan right now is for the Perseverance to go along and cache what scientists on Earth consider interesting rock samples.
Maybe biological. Who knows?
Maybe. And really something that it's much easier to study in our sophisticated labs here on Earth, and that's why we want to bring the rocks back. The idea would be that there would be another mission that comes along, collects those samples, and there's a small vehicle called the Mars Ascent Vehicle. And actually, NASA just awarded a contract to Northrop Grumman to build that rocket. And that rocket would blast those samples back into Mars orbit, rendezvous with another spacecraft, and then that would fly back to Earth.
Perseverance would, like, hand it over to it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Or they'd be it would, like, store it in places along its path, and this other rover would come along.
And pick them up.
This is all going to take time and money, so we're probably not looking at samples on Earth until about 2030, but the NASA and the European Space Agency are working very hard on that.
Mike in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Hey, George, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. And Eric, wow, what a great conversation tonight. I had a comment and a question. So right now there's a few countries that have really heavy interest in Mars and colonizing Mars, you know, this being the United Emirates, China, and the United States. And, you know, all of these countries, especially the Emirates, which launched the Emirati Hope Orbiter, have seemed to be working, you know, somewhat in conjunction to explore Mars. But, you know, Eric, the question I wanted to ask you is, you know, how much importance do you think Elon Musk feels it is to have the United States actually be the first to have people land on Mars and colonize Mars first? Thank you.
So the caller is very well informed, George.
Oh, yes. He's
right,
a genius.
That he's absolutely right that the UAE is interest has like a 100-year plan to settle Mars and is very interested and ambitious about that. In terms of, is Elon Musk committed to sending humans from the United States to Mars first? I think the answer to that is probably yes, because his company is based in the United States and we have export restrictions. So it would be very, very difficult for SpaceX to just decide it was going to up and move to Abu Dhabi or Australia or China, mm-hmm. because you can't really do that with the current export restrictions in space, because rockets are basically could be weapons, and those can't be exported. And I think he's worked with NASA for 15 years. They have a good relationship. And so any partnership he's going to do ultimately will be with NASA or will be on his own, certainly with Americans, I would think.
First-time caller Scott in Hudson, Wisconsin. Scott, let's get you in before the break. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks, George. I really appreciate it. And I wanted to say one thing quick, George. All the years I've listened to you, and when you first took over from Art, you were great, and you're still getting better, and it's just amazing. And programs like this, wow, it's gold in a sea of stuff you just don't want to listen to. And Eric, you're fantastic. I wanted to say a quick few things. When I first saw Elon Musk on YouTube, he was being interviewed in the back of a van. I think he's still on YouTube. And I saw him, and I said to myself, that guy's really, he's got it. And I invested every dollar I had in Tesla at the time. It was $26 a share.
Wow.
I thought I was brilliant. I sold all of it at 50. So not so brilliant. But I wanted to say this. Eric, you've mentioned two things that a lot of people haven't said about Elon. It's his drive and that he brings youth into the equation that I think has made him so successful at both Tesla and at SpaceX. And I just wanted to mention quickly, if you looked at the movies when we first did the Apollo mission, we had the great films celebrating that a year ago. You saw the guys in Mission Control. Those guys were in their late 20s and early 30s. Some of those guys who were building the main rockets on Apollo, some of the management was in their late 20s. And a lot of our companies, like United Launch Alliance, basically it became collusion to just sandbag. And there's a fantastic YouTube video where Elon Musk does a congressional hearing. It's still on. I just looked at it. And he says that for $380 million, you can buy one launch on United Launch Alliance. But for $100 million, you can get a launch from him and buy the GPS satellite at the same time. And it's just a beautiful piece of work. And so I think Elon has a titanium nose cone for a head. I think he's brilliant. His drive and what he does with youth, he takes these brilliant PhDs and he combines it with new technology like 3D printing to make convoluted space engine parts, or rocket engine parts that you had to make 10 or 20 perfect pieces. Now you can print them. He takes those guys and he says, let's run for the roses. If we can do it, we're going to do it. If we can't do it, we're going to try. And that is what really makes him amazing. And it's been a parable for America that, you know, a lot of our companies, I think we became older and we started to rest on our laurels. And man, Elon Musk and you, Eric, for bringing up the drive and the youth. It's not just that those guys come in and they have a chance to work for Elon. I think that's the core recipe that Elon brought to Tesla and SpaceX. And to me, it shows the brilliant future that we all have. Just there's so many places Elon can apply that formula, from solar panels on rooftops to anything else. And when we really start to go in an unfettered way, I can't wait to watch what happens. So thanks again, guys.
Thank you, Scotty. It's fantastic. We're going to come back and take more phone calls with Eric Berger, author of Liftoff, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, one of the famous Bartholomew brothers joins us, Paul. His other brother is Robert, of course. They wrote a book called The Mysterious North Woods about how the paranormal and cryptozoology mesh together. So we're going to be talking with them about some strange anomalies on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our final segment with Eric Berger. His book is called Liftoff. Where do people get your book, Eric? Is it all over the place?
It's all over the place. You're going to get a Kindle, hardcover, Audible, whatever you like.
I guess Jeff Bezos will take it off Amazon after tonight, right?
No. Not.
No, it's a great book, by the way. It's fun. What's your next project? What are you working on now?
I'm looking at potentially writing about a small company in New Zealand called Rocket Lab. which also has an orbital rocket and has a really fascinating backstory of this, just this small group of people in New Zealand who managed to come together and put together a rocket.
What do you think of Robert Bigelow trying to develop a space hotel?
You know, he had a brilliant idea to try to license the NASA technology to make these inflatable habitats in space. And it sounds crazy, right? You wouldn't really want to live in a balloon in space because you'd be afraid it's going to pop. But these inflatables are more durable than you might think. And because they can fold in on themselves, you can get a much larger place to live in space. And so, you know, the technology is coming along slowly. You'd like to see it move faster, but I think it's a great idea.
I bet room service will be very slow, though.
Room service will be very slow, but you'll sleep like a baby because all the troubles will be lifted away from you in microgravity.
Let's go to Ed, Charlotte, North Carolina, to get us started. Hey, Eddie, go ahead.
Hey, George. Yeah, you know, I guess the guy that mentioned you're getting better might be right, because every interview gives you more background information, and you've got such a huge amount that you're a genius at being able to pull from it and come up with the greatest questions ever, sure enough.
Thank you, Edward.
Mr. Berger, I appreciate you letting us know your ideas about Musk with having spent as much time as you have with him. That's very interesting. And I got two quick news items. He tweeted today that they have just submitted to the FCC a request to begin installing and operating terminals on moving vehicles. And he pointed out it won't be the Tesla cars because it's too large, but it's for to be used for aircraft, ships, large trucks, and RVs, as well as people. And I think you don't have to have routers for these things and so forth. And then I got to see Bezos' new patent he just got. I saw five drawings. It may be announced as early as tomorrow, March 9th. It's hard to believe. He's going to put his satellites up with no rockets. No cost.
How's he going to do that?
He's got a kind of a slingshot whip thing in the drawing where I guess a plane will pull it on a cord and sling them up there.
It better be way up there.
I agree with Berger. I think Musk is a little ahead in this area, but like you say, George, with all Bezos' money, can hire the right guy, and he comes up with some out-of-the-box idea like this, and it works, it's saving him a lot.
What do you think of a slingshot launcher, Eric?
Well, the caller is right. Bezos has patented that idea, and this is this futuristic way of trying to launch, as the caller says, with a slingshot mechanism. I can tell you that in the near term, he is very much going to be using rockets to get his Project Kuiper satellites into space. Again, this is the satellite internet we were talking about earlier, George. This is one other dimension of the current space race. He's building a large rocket called New Glenn, and he hopes to fly that within a couple of years, and I suspect that's how he'll initially at least get his satellites into space.
In the state of Washington we go. Brandon is with us, west of the Rockies. Hello, Brandon.
Hi, George and Eric. First, I do want to mention that at 10:53 p.m. PST, you forgot to mention Sergei Korolev, the Soviet chief designer. You mentioned Wernher von Braun, who was Wernher von Braun's counterpart in the Soviets.
Right.
And then
right. Sergei Korolev was a genius in Russia and was largely responsible for them beating the America into space, both with the Sputnik satellite that you mentioned, George, as well as Yuri Gagarin's human spaceflight.
First flight, yeah.
Absolutely.
And I have a question for both of you. Did you two hear about the sounds that the Perseverance probe or rover recorded? And if so, did you listen to it? Thank you.
Yes, we heard the sound. I heard it. Did you, Eric?
Oh, definitely. I was on that news conference where they released the first pictures of the landing and all the sounds from the surface of Mars, and it sounded great, but you don't want to take your helmet off, George, because if you do, your head will explode in about, 10 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of eerie, isn't it?
Yeah, it sounded really, you love to hear it, right? I mean, we've never heard sounds from another world before, so it was remarkable.
It's kind of lonely, actually.
Well, that was how Buzz Aldrin described the moon, as magnificent desolation, and I think that applies to Mars as well. It's pretty lonely.
Could you imagine an astronaut on Mars or even the moon standing there looking around at everything and just having nobody there? It's crazy.
I mean, yeah, and that's why what Elon wants to do is build these large starships to send dozens of people at a time so you can start to have a real settlement as opposed to a NASA mission, which might have two or four astronauts. So that's the goal, to really make it so it's less lonely.
Next up on the wild card line, Mark is in Baltimore, Maryland. Hello, Mark.
Hi, George. Thank you so much. It's an honor and a privilege once again to speak to you. And Mr. Berger, the same to you. You're so articulate and open-minded and right to the point that it's so refreshing. And so my question is, I have a two-part question. First is, because of the accomplishments that Mr. Musk is making, what, if any, impact is it actually having on what I think is known as the Artemis program for NASA and the Space Launch System? And then the second part of my question was, is Elon Musk doing anything about trying to discover cold fusion?
So in regard to cold fusion, not that I'm aware of. The caller also asked about the Artemis program and the Space Launch System. And this is NASA's program to try to return humans to the moon by 2024. And right now, the agency's planning to use a rocket built by Boeing for NASA called the Space Launch System. And, you know, we've talked about how SpaceX has disrupted things. And this rocket, NASA has given Boeing $20 billion, George, over the last decade. And this rocket still hasn't flown once.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. So what SpaceX has done in building rockets is really starting to surpass what NASA's been able to do. So I suspect ultimately if we do send humans to the moon for NASA, it will be on SpaceX rockets, not in the Space Launch System.
So you think that Soviet scientist was the one really responsible for Sputnik, not the German scientist they brought over?
America got the better German rocket scientist.
We did.
Werner von Braun brought his better people with him, and there was a race to get him, and we got there before the Soviets did. Korolev was an absolute genius, for sure.
So regardless of what we got, they would have beaten us anyway then, with him.
I think so, yeah.
Charles in Boston, welcome to the show. Hey, Charles, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Eric. It's been a while since we've spoken, but we've communicated a little bit recently. This is Charles Lurio. Been involved in the
Hi, Charles.
Yeah, hi. It took a moment there to recognize the voice.
Now he's got you down, Charles.
Yeah, thanks for having Eric on.
Sure,
George. I'm sure I know it's a fantastic book. From all I've heard, I'm definitely going to be reading it.
Yeah, it is great.
I wanted to point out that there were a number of us, a small group of folks, who for a couple of decades or so before Elon came along, were pushing to try to get alternatives to NASA going, just like Elon, or just like, you know, Elon Bezos and the whole crowd, including. You know, basically the whole commercial space idea, and it was a tough road to hoe because people were so convinced that space was equivalent to NASA, and vice versa, but it's just amazing now to see what's going on daily with SpaceX and with Elon's progress, and also with the folks like Rocket Lab, which Eric mentioned.
That's all true. Eric, you want to react to that?
Yeah, so Charles is exactly right. You know, in the 1970s and 1980s, there were definitely efforts to build up a commercial space industry, but it really remained more promise than reality. And what one of Elon Musk's great achievements is that he showed that commercial space could become profitable. And Charles is right. The established industry didn't want them to come along, And, you know, and as I write in the book, I mean, that almost crushed him. The failures almost crushed him. And you know, SpaceX very nearly failed on multiple occasions. So, you know, we're lucky that they made it through. And because they were successful, now we've seen a bunch of other space companies come along with a similar idea of using private capital to get us further out into space.
Well, next up, Brian's in the state of Washington. Welcome aboard, Brian.
Oh, excellent. Thank you, George. Eric, I work for a company. I won't say the name, but it'll probably be easy to figure it out. Washington State. I work for this commercial airliner company. And
is it a big one? It's a big one, isn't it, Brian?
Yeah, it's kind of a big one.
Yeah.
And what I was going to ask Eric was, like, the competition, like, safer space, like with Elon, I think competition is great. For this particular company I'm talking about, say they're going against Airbus and how they, you know, well, of course, lawsuits and everything else they go through. But ain't it great for – I was wondering how Elon likes competition to strive for – I think you end up with a better technology when you've got two people going at it,
mm-hmm.
than just, say, one company alone going out, and maybe they'll get, like, stalemate. So that's just what I have to ask.
Competition is healthy, is it not, Eric?
Oh, without a doubt. So the Washington-based airline company that your caller does not want to mention was in direct competition with SpaceX. NASA recognized the value of that. So after the space shuttle retired, they picked two companies, SpaceX and Boeing, to build transportation systems to replace the shuttle to get astronauts into low Earth orbit. And NASA knew that by having Boeing and SpaceX working competitively, that it would make the program go faster, and in fact, it did. SpaceX ultimately won that competition. They had their first human launch last year, but Boeing is coming along and probably will launch humans later this year for the first time.
Remember that movie that Tom Hanks was in? He was an astronaut, and they're all sitting in the space capsule ready to launch. And they said, how do you feel knowing that we're sitting on a spaceship built by the lowest bidder?
Yeah, I mean, yes, that was a great movie, Apollo 13, and it does make you wonder. I mean, space flight's very risky. I mean, it's not hard. I mean, it's not easy to break out of Earth's gravity well, for sure.
First-time caller Jerry in Waco, Texas. Welcome, Jerry.
Hi, how you doing, guys?
Okay.
Hey, I work for Boeing in the satellite division in El Segundo. And we used SpaceX to send those satellites up into space. So there wasn't competition, but we did use them. And also, since I wasn't very far from Hawthorne, which is their headquarters at SpaceX, I'd drive by there on a Sunday morning at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, and there'd be 20, 30 people, engineers, young people, coming out of the offices. And I'm thinking, wow, those people work night
and day. Yeah.
And the third thing was I worked on the Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands, and SpaceX had a launch pad there, which you don't hear about anymore. Do you know if that's been abandoned or if that's for secret use for special projects?
Yeah, so that's brilliant, because when I talked about when SpaceX had to leave Vandenberg and find another place, they did go to the Kwajalein Atoll to launch from a small island there called Amalek. And so it was extraordinarily difficult to launch a rocket in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I mean, imagine, George, you have to get liquid oxygen, which is at, you know, hundreds of degrees below freezing, and the only way to get it there is to put it on a container ship and ship it from Los Angeles to Hawaii, then to Kwaj. It's half of it boils off. I mean, it's all these challenges. The caller asked about Amalek Island. SpaceX launched from there five times, and then in 2009 they left. And when they left, they had to take everything away and return it to its natural state. All of the concrete there had to be crushed into rocks smaller than 1 inch across, and so it's been abandoned. However, I can tell you there's another rocket company, it's called Astra, that may start launching from Amalek within a year or two. So it could be coming back.
Eric, since you've been doing this, fascinated with space, and we only got 30 seconds left, what has been the most challenging aspect of what you've covered so far?
You know, it's been difficult to cover SpaceX, frankly, George, because Elon is a pretty private guy and keeps the company pretty buttoned up. So it's been a real privilege to finally crack that eggshell and really get to understand the story behind the story.
This is really the first major book on SpaceX, isn't it?
It's certainly the first one to go really deep into the Falcon 1 and those early struggles that ultimately paid off for them, yeah.
Super. Eric, thanks. And once again, for people who want to contact you, they can do so through your website?
You can do it through Ars Technica. You can find me as SciGuySpace on Twitter. You bet.
All right, my friend. Be well. Keep in touch with us, Eric, okay?
Thank you, George.
Any breaking news, let's have you come on as a news source for us as well. Up next, we're going to take a little walk on the paranormal side on Coast to Coast AM.